Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. On Sunday, June 23rd, the winter racing season at Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California finally came to a close. And on Saturday, June 22nd, the 30th horse died in racing or training at Santa Anita this year. That's a lot of horse deaths. But there are a lot of horse deaths every year. In 2018, 493 thoroughbreds died in racing or training. Today, I'm talking to Patrick Batuello. He started the organization Horse Racing Wrongs in 2012. There's been a lot of talk of reforms in the horse racing world right now. But the reforms and the restrictions that have already been put in place aren't really working. Horses are still dying. And so Patrick and Horse Racing Wrongs take a different approach. A complete abolition of horse racing, period. And with all these deaths, I can't see how more people aren't going to get behind them. This is a really big year for your organization, and not in a good way, but in terms of media attention and horse racing deaths. There's been 29 at Santa Anita. There's been how many through the country?
Actually, it's 35, Beth. We have six other horses who died back in their stalls. And when you see the reports in the mainstream media, it's always the 29 who died on track. But clearly, those other six are casualties of the industry. So 35 thus far at Santa Anita. But it's important to remember that this is not an anomaly.
Those numbers are incredible. To tell you the truth, so back before I was a vegan, and even though I loved animals and horses, I went to the track. And I lived in LA, and I went to Santa Anita.
Sure.
This was early 2000s, and I went a lot.
Yeah.
Like, we went with friends. Horses died a lot back then, too, at Santa Anita. I saw them. And even though I would be at the track, and I would see when they would bring the big screens out and the horse ambulance, and you knew a horse was being put down right there, and it was this horrible moment, and the entire track would get really quiet. Even that, I still came back a month later. And
sure.
I was an animal. I mean, I am an animal person, but that's how big the disconnect was for me.
Sure. And that disconnect is a direct result of conditioning. We have been told that this is a sport since birth. It's been, covered by NBC Sports, the Triple Crown races. It's been on the cover of Sports Illustrated 46 times in the first 30 years of Sports Illustrated. Secretariat was named the 35th greatest athlete of the 20th century by ESPN. It's under that banner of sport. And so when these things happen, or in the past when they happened on the track, the industry will tell you, well, this is what happens sometimes to athletes. They'll break a bone, but unfortunately for horses, a broken bone usually means euthanasia. So they try to make that connection between a football player who, tears an Achilles and is done for the season, and a racehorse who snaps a cannon bone and has to be euthanized, trying to make that correlation. In fact, this is nothing but animal exploitation, animal cruelty, and animal killing. So our challenge is unique within the animal rights community. Even greyhound racing was never really considered a sport, and most people recognized it as a gambling business. Horse racing is the sport of kings in the public mind. So when most people think of horse racing today, they look at it as dirty, perhaps corrupt, too many drugs, kind of liken it to baseball during the steroid era. So it needs a good house cleaning, but ban it? That's crazy. This is a sport. There's a tradition behind it. So our challenge is to break through that mindset and to make people see it for what it actually is.
Exploitation and abuse.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what's happened just in the animal entertainment realm over the past few years, Ringling Brothers is done for good after 146 years of abusing animals. SeaWorld has ended its captive breeding program for orcas, due almost exclusively to exposure from blackfish, and remains in decline. Greyhound racing, this past November, Floridians voted overwhelmingly, over 2-1, to outlaw greyhound racing, a move that will shutter 11 of the final 17 tracks, leaving greyhound racing in America all but dead. There are elephant bands for entertainment, both in New York and Illinois. Rodeo bands in cities as diverse as San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Pasadena, Fort Wayne. So clearly this is going in one direction. And so what we are here to ask the American people is why should horse racing be exempt? You know, especially given that the scale of the carnage and the depth of the suffering dwarfs all those other industries as bad as they were and are combined.
No animals died in these numbers in any of those industries.
No. And again, it's cruel. We are categorically against all animal exploitation. They're all appalling. But horse racing, again, has been given this exemption. And, you know, you mentioned how you used to go to the track. I went to the track a handful of times. We're in Saratoga Country. I went to the Traverse, which is the social event of the capital region, you know, for the summer. I was a big sports fan growing up in the 70s and 80s. I didn't follow racing intensively, but I do remember tuning in around Triple Crown time, rooting on Seattle Slew and Affirmed, because it was presented to me as just another sport. The most exciting 2 minutes in sports is the Kentucky Derby bills itself. Saratoga actually calls itself the oldest sporting venue in the nation. It's a huge challenge for us is to break through that. We are making progress, though.
Okay, so what is it about this year? I know there's been a lot of deaths, especially at Santa Anita this year, but there's a lot of deaths every year, correct?
Every year, right.
Is it just getting a lot more attention this year?
For whatever reason, at some point, the national media latched onto this. It's one of those great mysteries. Santa Anita seemed to be having a lot in a shorter period of time. At some point, first the local media, then the national media started picking up on this. They found that the American public does care about this issue. It's one of those things that I think we'll look back on Santa Anita as the tipping point.
Before we keep going, I want to just go backwards and talk about how this all started. Because before you, nobody was really doing this like solely. There's bits and pieces of different animal rights groups saying horse racing is terrible.
Right.
But nobody was really fighting horse racing as their sole purpose.
Right. And that's how I got into this. I was writing the animal rights blog for the Times Union, here, the Albany's newspaper, and I was trying to cover every different issue. And I got to horse racing and I started doing some research, and there was a dearth of information out there. I was aware of slaughter. You know, some prominent outlets, including HBO, had covered it. But no one was taking this industry on. Not PETA, not the HSUS. There was no organization like ours is today that was documenting the cruelty and the killing. Initially, I started reviewing the official race charts, and I still to this day do that every morning. They're like box scores almost for the bettors. They give you a bunch of information, you know, conditions, odds, payouts, and then performance numbers. But there's notes for each of the horses, and sometimes within those notes you can find some of the bad. So I started learning about vanned off, which means a horse is ambulanced off the track. Pulled up in distress usually is a bad outcome. Pulled up lame. Then, of course, there's, you know, the euphemisms, as a rule, euphemisms for death, like went wrong and broke down.
Take me through a morning. You start looking at all the, what is it
called? Sure, it's called Equibase is the website.
Okay.
So, again, every thoroughbred quarter horse race run in America is documented on this website. So I'll go through with the charts for every race, you know, run in the country the day before.
And on a typical morning, how many horse deaths are there?
Well, when I first started, interestingly, very rarely would you see a euthanasia mentioned in the chart notes. Again, it was that code word, broke down, which virtually without fail means the horse is dead. But the real information for me comes with my FOIA requests. So I put these Freedom of Information Act requests in with each racing state directly to the racing commissions. And I start to get this documentation from them because they're required by law to submit it. I'm asking for the names of the horses who died or were euthanized on that state's tracks. And then I ask for, you know, specific details like how the horse died, whether it was in racing or training or back in the stall, the date, the location, those kinds of things. And from there, I started compiling these killed in action lists, which go back to 2014, which are roughly 1,000 strong each year. Those are just the ones that I have confirmed, names, dates, locations. But for various reasons, most prominently, private training facilities. And there are twice as many of those as there are open to the public racetracks. I have no access, you know, to what's going on those tracks.
And then how many are sent to slaughter every year on top of
slaughter, that? Slaughter, is perhaps the worst of it. There have been two studies, to my knowledge, done as to identify the breeds of American horses going to slaughter. We do know how many American horses actually go across the Canadian and Mexican border to go to slaughter.
Is it around 100,000?
It's been around 130,000. The last year or two, it's declined a little bit because the Europeans have pretty much boycotted any horse meat coming from Mexico for health reasons. There's a high demand for horse meat in Europe and Asia, and that's why they slaughter horses. But as far as the racing industry and how they play a part, these two studies, one had the number of thoroughbreds at 16% of the total, and one had it at 19%. And this was done through USDA data. It was done when horse slaughter was still happening on U.S. soil. So we had access to all this information. There's no reason to believe that the numbers still don't apply. This is only, 10 years ago. So 16%, 19%, you can see these numbers are huge. I mean, close to 20,000. So even if we were to give the industry the benefit of the doubt, say it's 12%, we're still talking about 15,000 thoroughbreds alone bled out and butchered annually. Just thoroughbreds, not even accounting for standardbreds and quarter horses. So we say with full confidence, and it has never been challenged by anyone from the industry, that the vast majority of spent or simply no longer wanted racehorses are brutally and violently slaughtered.
Well, and a lot of them, not that it makes a difference, but a lot of them are babies.
A lot of them are babies. In the end, anytime money and animals mix, the animals lose. So these are mere commodities, these horses. And when they're not producing, when they're no longer profitable, they get shipped out. And often they're 3, 4, 5 years old, still pubescence.
And I've talked about slaughter with people on the podcast before, but for people who don't know, can you just take me through the process from the time a horse is deemed done or not raceable anymore?
The industry, if they were sitting here today, would say, well, look, we have strict no slaughter policies. And this came actually in the wake of HBO's initial piece on slaughter back in 2008. They were exposed. So they came out with these no slaughter policies. They're not worth the paper that they're written on. Basically, it says that if a trainer or owner is caught selling his or her horse to slaughter, they will lose their license. Well, clearly, there are ways around that. So you go through middlemen. If a horse is no longer, running well, you would just find a broker to pass that horse on to, and you have plausible deniability. Well, I didn't sell my horse directly to the slaughterhouse. I sold it to so-and-so. Well, that so-and-so will send him down to what are called kill auctions. And they're general livestock auctions, but they're frequented by what are called kill buyers, who represent the Canadian and Mexican slaughterhouses. So these kill buyers will put bids in on these horses, and typically, they go for anywhere from $300 to $500. Not much. Euthanasia disposal would cost maybe $300 or $400. So if they were to do right by the horse and euthanize, it wouldn't cost a whole lot of money to do that. So they end up in these these auction houses. If they get bid on by a kill buyer, they'll end up in a kill pen, what's called a kill pen. Sometimes they'll go to a feedlot to beef them up a little bit, so they can get more money from the slaughterhouse. And then they get shipped, often hundreds, if not, 1,000 miles to the border, either Canada or Mexico, where the USDA has determined they can go 28 to 36 hours without food, water, or rest. It's horrific. It's equine hell. I mean, they're crammed in there. They're scared. They don't know what's happening. They get to the slaughterhouse.
Which is either Canada
or Mexico. And it's a cold concrete building. They're herded in. I have this quote from a Canadian activist I thought really brought home, the feel of these places. These horses are desperately looking for a friendly face, even among the slaughterhouse workers, because that's how they were raised and bred as domesticated animals.
How so? What do you mean?
They're used to interacting with human beings. So they're looking for some sort of, a friendly face that's going to take them away from where they are. And make no mistake, they know where they are. The sights, sounds, and smells of death are all around. We're vegan, so obviously we are against all animal slaughter. That said, horse slaughter is particularly egregious. they are flight animals, prey animals. So their instinct is to go. And they're in what's called the kill box. And there are two methods used, typically either a 22 caliber rifle or the captive bolt, which is used on cattle. Cattle are more docile. Again, not in any way defending it, but it's easier to render a cow either dead or insensible to pain. The horse will start flailing. And in addition, the horse's brain is toward the back of the skull, making it more difficult to get a clean shot. There is video from Canada, from activists, showing a man with a 22 caliber rifle shooting, not getting a clean kill shot off. The horse is wounded, flailing about in the box, slipping and sliding on these concrete floors that's made even more slippery by the blood from the previous horse. He has to reload, and he walks nonchalantly across the room to get more ammunition. Meanwhile, the horse is dying. Comes back. Sometimes it takes multiple shots. But that said, there are horses who will end up being shackled by their hind legs, hoisted upside down, and slashed through the carotid artery, still conscious, bled out while still conscious. It's gruesome, it's violent, it's brutal, and I don't know how anyone could support an industry where most of those animals end up in such a place. In America, we are repelled by the thought of horse slaughter. I think I've seen polling that says 80 to 85% of Americans are against horse slaughter. That's why there are no more horse slaughterhouses on U.S. soil. We have an aversion to it, and yet we support industries that supply these animals. So it's that disconnect, and that's what our challenge, again, is to get that information out to the public and make them understand that for all actions, there are consequences. They're the consequence of a seemingly innocuous $2 bet on a Saturday afternoon are either horse breaking down 2,000 times a year or the slaughterhouse for the vast majority.
Is the gambling what really perpetuates the racing industry more than anything else?
It is. It's a gambling industry. That's what it is. It's, you know, all that romantic rhetoric aside, you know, the sporting, you know, terminology, it's about gambling. And we say that today, there's no excuse. Where 50 years ago, it may have been the only legal way to place a bet. Now we have casinos all over the place. Almost every state has lotteries, if not all states. And soon, there'll be all sports betting sweeping the country. In fact, in New York, it's been approved. So you could bet on football or baseball legally. You don't have to go through a bookie anymore. There's no reason to bet on the backs of suffering animals. And that's been one of the major arguments that has brought down the greyhound racing industry, and it will ultimately bring down the horse racing industry.
I want to talk more about the disconnect. It just always astonishes me when I have these moments of, how did I not see that for so many years?
Sure.
And then you have these moments of like, wait, and you wake up.
Yeah.
But for me, and I'm someone who was a very big animal person, but for people who really aren't even thinking about animals, and if they did, they would say they're against any sort of slaughter or abuse, or it's all good people, right? But it's that message is even so much farther away.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing I want to talk about are the myths that happen within the horse racing industry. Namely, people think, oh, all these horses have really good lives.
Right.
I hear that.
Mm-hmm. So the typical racehorse is kept locked alone in a tiny 12 by 12 stall for over 23 hours a day. That is a horrible existence. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the orcas down at SeaWorld and the Ringling elephants, you know, and for good reason. We fully support what's happening with those two industries, but it's no different than what the racehorses endure. Part of the disconnect is that elephants and orcas are considered wild animals. But it's that idea that they should be out in the jungle or in the deep ocean, where horses have always been, for thousands of years, domesticated. And, you know, they've always been kept in you know, stables and stalls. And so people don't see that as a cruelty. We're trying to make them understand that that's what it is. These are naturally social, herd-oriented animals, kept alone. They're torn from their mothers as mere babes, thrust into training far before their bones are done maturing. I mean, the typical horse will mature at six. a typical racehorse is put into training at 18 months, which is the rough equivalent of a 5 or 6 year old child. Intensive training. And then, of course, there's that confinement and isolation. And for me, Beth, that may be the worst of it, is that confinement. On our advisory board, we have Dr. Nicholas Dodman, who is one of the foremost experts in equine behavior, retired Tufts professor. I asked him about the confinement, and he said he likens it to a human that has to spend years in solitary confinement. And so what you see with these horses, just like we saw with the Ringland elephants and the SeaWorld orcas, is those stereotypies or vices, you know, the cribbing, you know, the incessant, chewing on the stall door, the pacing, the bobbing, the weaving, the kicking, and even self-mutilation. They're going mad. So, you know, for these people to come and say, well, they're treated better than you and me, it's absurd. We have to break through that mindset. Well, this is the way horses have always been kept. They're used to it. That's what they're bred to do. You have to start looking at it through a fresh lens.
Right. And what else do you hear? What sort of other arguments do? I just think there's a lot of really uninformed general public that feels like, hey, this isn't so bad.
Yeah. One of the most obscene assertions that they make is that we look at them as, you know, our children, members of our family.
As the owners do.
Yeah, the owners and trainers will talk about the horses. Like, you have no idea how much blood, sweat, and tears we put into these, and we cry when they break down. My answer to that is, well, would you, you know, lock your child in a bathroom, you know, for 23 and a half hours a day? Would you drug and dope your child to make him perform better? Would you beat your child with a whip? And then, of course, can you identify, would you lose track of your child at some point in his or her life, like they do with their horses? You know, they don't know where all their horses are, and most of them are indeed slaughtered. So it's an obscenity. There's no other way to put it, you know, for them to claim that these are like our children. They're just commodities. That's all.
And has the industry, has there been a decline in numbers of attendance at races and people betting in general?
Yeah. In fact, this industry is contracting as we speak.
That's what it feels like.
Right. Since 2000, the U.S. industry has suffered a net loss of 34 tracks. All other metrics, race days, races, field sizes, the number of horses running in a race, the full crop, that's the number of new thoroughbreds coming into the system. All those numbers are down, and attendance and handle, which is the amount of money bet on the races, is down. Some of those, 50% of what they were just 30 years ago. Clearly, horse racing is contracting and in decline. So clearly, the public doesn't want it like it used to. The younger generations especially are eschewing horse racing. There are two reasons for that. One, there is more competition for the gambling dollar. Clearly, you know, you can go to a casino and bet. You can play lotteries.
You can bet online.
You can bet online. But the second is the changing sensibilities toward animal exploitation, especially entertainment. So if you're a 25-year-old, that's all you've known is this, you know, the internet, and growing up with that information at your fingertips, they get it. They understand. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't have access to all that information. So it was easier to sell horse racing as a sport than it is now.
Well, there was all this romance around it,
right? All this romance. I wanted to mention, you know, the movies too. I mean, Seabiscuit and Ruffian and Secretariat. It's really, for want of a better word, it's a brainwashing, the brainwashing of America. It's brilliant marketing, you know, to call it a sport when in fact it's just animal exploitation.
Well, even this year, it seems like after all the Santa Anita press, they got such a huge amount of press. It seems like, and maybe it was just my filter through it, but it seems like there's a little bit of, I don't know, this shame feeling of people go, how can you go when you know this?
There's two reasons to protest. You know, one is to get your message out there, and hopefully, you know, you attract media so you can get the message out exponentially. But the second is to make people uncomfortable. Not to call them names, and you know, we don't do that. We're not confrontational and say, you know, what you're doing is a bad thing. But to make them uncomfortable, to make them aware that, you know what, there's a lot of us out here today that are telling you that this is not what it is being sold to you as. You should open your mind to some facts And that's, you know, that's why we're out there with our signs and our leaflets. We are currently sponsoring protests at 21 tracks in 16 states, including Santa Anita. So it's a growing movement. People are becoming more aware of it. And again, when we're out there at Saratoga every week and we see these families coming with their children in tow, they're not there as hardcore bettors. There's always a certain element of, you know, of that. So we look at it as planting seeds. Again, we're not out to shame people. That's, you know, that's not what we're trying to do. None of us were born, you know, I mean, we're born compassionate, but that gets, you know, sometimes beaten down as you're growing up. We're not out to tell people that they're bad or that they're, you know, they're making unethical choices. We're just trying to plant seeds. And then maybe when they're in the quiet, you know, in their own room at nighttime, that they'll think about that and maybe make a different decision the next time.
Or Google it or look more into it and
sure.
See what's really happening.
Absolutely.
So there's so much talk now about changing regulations. Mm. And I know you guys are 100% opposed.
Right.
I mean, it's shut down or not.
Right.
And in terms of all that and in terms of the changing regulations, can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I look at this call for reform as a massive distraction. They got caught. And the first thing that they started doing at Santa Anita was, oh, we had a really bad winter, a lot of rain, hardened the track. When that didn't really pass muster, then they said, okay, well, we're going to give you some, you know, some reforms. Lasix, for example. Lasix is a drug that's almost universally given to horses in North America, Canada, and the U.S. It's to control ostensibly pulmonary bleeding. It's quite divisive within the industry. There are some who believe it to be just another performance enhancer because it's diuretic, so they shed water weight and they run faster. There are others who say, no, it's therapeutic. It's controlling pulmonary bleeding, and that's good for the horse. You know, we're trying to reduce their suffering. Lasix isn't killing these horses. So Lasix is, there's no direct connection between Lasix and these breakdowns. So that was just a big distraction. And then, of course, there's this bill before Congress called the Horse Racing Integrity Act, which is an oxymoron, you know, horse racing integrity. But it's supposed to put the industry under the auspices of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency and set up more of a national governing body instead of having each state make their own regulations. Again, I just see this as a big distraction. Drugs in general are very controversial within racing. Drug reform is not going to fix this industry. And there are things that they couldn't do or couldn't change. So I say that dead racehorses are inevitable. If they're not racing, they're not earning. So they have to keep them on the track, keep them racing. And that's where the drugs come in to control whatever injuries they may be incurring. And of course, what happens on the racetrack is totally unnatural. We're always told that horses are born to run and love to run. These horses are being beaten to run at a breakneck speed. Of course, it's unnatural. And then in addition, they are commodities. So they are changing hands multiple times over the course of their so-called careers, meaning that the window is usually short-term for the current trainer or owner. So they're not looking at the horse's long-term health and well-being. The bottom line here is they're not going to change any of those things. We're always going to have dead racehorses. It's always been. It always will be. So, I caution people to look beyond, you know, all this talk about reform. It sounds really good. It sounds appealing. When you compare it to, you know, animal circuses, marine mammal shows, greyhound racing, rodeos, it's no different. So, you know, we're still talking fundamentally about animal exploitation.
And if you look at all of those things, including Ringling Brothers, it was the public that actually just made those things come to an end.
Right. Ours is a hearts and minds campaign first and foremost. So we are out there to shape public opinion. We believe that the laws will follow. So you can't go to a politician and say, we want you to write a bill to ban horse racing unless we have shifted public opinion. And we are in the process of doing that. And we have engaged the media. So the media, sees that this story is appealing to the public, and they're not letting it drop. Through the media, we are able to affect, you know, far greater change. And then eventually, we will go for those legislative remedies. We will go for those outright bans. That's what happened with greyhound racing and the circus. That's why we are out there saying end horse racing, no reform, no compromise. Prior to maybe this year or the past couple of years, it was difficult for us to engage the animal rights community because this has been sold as sport. And so it wasn't one of those hot button issues. And I understand we talk about scale, certainly food, testing, you know, those are gigantic issues. But recently we've been heartened because we feel like it's changed, and all these protests are a testament to that we're getting the animal rights community engaged, and they're starting to see. I also think that was a natural evolution too. So, you know, Ringling goes away, SeaWorld's in decline, greyhound racing is on the verge of going away, you know. This seems like the next step.
Right. But I do think people still have, there's a barrier between Ringling, SeaWorld, all of those, because that for so long people have said, oh my gosh, this is terrible.
Right.
And I think what's now happening and what you're doing is putting horses, hey, this is worse.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing I did want to talk about is, you know, often people hear, well, they die. What does that mean? He broke a leg. And, you know, we know that horses aren't good candidates for surgery and recovery, and that's why they have to euthanize. You know, death, yes, the majority of cases is a broken, you know, limb of some sort, but it also comes in other forms, like what are called sudden cardiac events. You know, it's a cardiovascular collapse. You know, these are, again, horses who are still in puberty. Their hearts just give out. They'll die of pulmonary hemorrhage, that bleeding from the lungs. They'll die of blunt force head trauma from collisions with other horses or the track itself. They'll break their necks.
So I watched the video of you when you were speaking in front of the New York State Senate Committee, and you set it up saying, hey, now I'm going to read you 30 names of the thousands of horses that died this year with the cause of death. Yeah. And I thought right before, like in the split second, I was like, 30 is a lot to read. Yeah. And then you started reading them. Wow, was that powerful.
And I'll tell you, if your listeners can read and share anything on my site, I would ask them to go to the very top of the homepage. It's called How They Die. And that's, you know, a more extensive list of, you know, from those 30. And the descriptions, which I'm getting, mind you, directly from the racing industry. These aren't my words. It is shocking. It is vile.
Like I said, I was like, 30's a lot.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it was just like, you know, broke both front ankles and hooves were hanging by the skin.
Or fragments of bone, you know, on the dirt, or in the dirt, you know, just horrible.
Just gruesome death, you know, after gruesome death.
Horses that are impaled, you know, if they go through the gate, hit the gate, horrible ways to die. It's horrific. And I think, again, people need to hear those details.
Because I do think that there is this like series of nudging,
right?
Like, look at this, and this happened, and this happened.
Right.
And that is much more of what wakes people up or allows people to see.
Well, and you're always trying to balance because, you know, if you become too graphic, you know, it may dissuade people from even looking into it. You know, some people don't, I don't want to hear. But at the same time, they need to know how bad it is, that it's not, you know, it's not a peaceful death in any way. And especially when they get to the slaughterhouse, they need to hear those details because that's how and I always say, look, if it's unpleasant for you to hear or read, imagine what it is for that horse to experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Even though what's happening in American horse racing has been all over the press lately, I still think not many people know how many horses are dying on the track and also at the slaughterhouse. So this is an important conversation to share. If you want to learn more about Patrick and Horse Racing Wrongs, check out their website. It's horseracingwrongs.com. Our website is speciesunite.com, and we're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. We're also on Patreon, so if you feel so inclined to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review because it helps people find our show. Thanks again, and thanks to everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Anna Kollner, and a special thanks to Allison Berenger. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.